want to turn to introducing our wonderful, Abigail Pokerben is the author of Stars of David, Prominent Jews Talk About Being Jewish, which was adapted musically for an off-Broadway production. She also wrote One and the Same, which delves into the truth about growing up as an identical twin, and the best-selling Kindle single, Showstopper, about her teenage adventure on Broadway in Sondheim's flop, Merrily We Roll Along. A Yale graduate, Abigail was a producer for Charlie Rose and the Lawyers at PBS, then for Ed Bradley and Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. She was a co-author of Newsweek's controversial Top Rabbis list and has also been published in New York Magazine, Tablet, The Daily Beast, and many other publications. She currently writes a column for The Forward about living every single Jewish holiday in our calendar, and it's really been such a contribution. 18 holidays, one wandering Jew. She has her own interview series at the JCC in Manhattan called What Everyone's Talking About. Abby lives in Manhattan with her husband and two teenage children. And Letty Cotton Pokerben, a founding editor of Ms. Magazine, is the author of 11 books, most recently her second novel, Single Jewish Male Seeking Soulmate, which will be published next month, as well as the 2013 guidebook, How to Be a Friend to a Friend Who is Sick, and her classic memoir, Deborah, Golda, and Me, Being Female and Jewish in America. She won an Emmy Award for her work as the editorial consultant on Free to Be You and Me, Marlo Thomas's groundbreaking children's book, record, and television special. Her articles have appeared in many print and online publications, including The New York Times, The Huffington Post, The Nation, and Tablet magazine. She served two terms as president of the Authors Guild and 4 years as president of Americans for Peace Now. She is also co-founder of a dozen or more Jewish or feminist organizations and currently serves on the boards of the Brandeis University Women and Gender Studies Program and the Harvard Divinity School Women in Religion Program. Letty lives in New York with her husband Bert, an attorney. They have 3 grown children and 6 grandchildren. And Rabbi Konigsberg is reminding me to remind you that cards were passed out, and if folks want to jot down questions while Letty and Abby are in dialogue, and we'll pass them to the aisles, and Rabbi Konigsberg will be coming around to get them because we'll be collecting questions during the program. With great love and respect and appreciation, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, everyone, for coming today. I'm always a little embarrassed by that introduction. I mean, it's all facts, but it's embarrassing, and I would respond with humility, except I always remember Golda's favorite line, "Don't be humble, you're not that great." So, you know, being Jewish, I'm coming to you with a kvetch and a kvel. You might say it's like Moses' face when he came down from Sinai with the tablets, and he told the children of Israel, "I have good news and bad news." The good news is I got them down to 10. The bad news, adultery is still in. So all this is true of 30 years of women in the rabbinate as well, as we heard this morning. I must confess, grateful as I am to be standing here, I think I would have rather had in our place a panel of women rabbis. I think we need to hear from people like Amy Oliver, who was here and has been named and has been cited. And we need to hear from graduates from this year, those who are going to graduate, those who just graduated, those who are facing what we've all been talking about. And we need people in the middle. And we've heard some of them from the microphones in the question period. But leave you with that. Let's consider this the first of many conferences on women in the rabbinate. That's not just go home and say, okay, now we know it all, we've done it all. It reminds me of, in 1988, several of us in this room, Lou among them, big friend, you were there. We all went to Jerusalem for the first annual Jewish feminist conference. We distinguished ourselves by getting all the nominations to the Kotel, the Western Wall, and prayed and agreed on a methodology. You were there, Jackie. Agreed on a methodology of prayer that allowed everybody to feel included and authentic and expressive, and we never got any credit for pioneering in that regard. And more to my point, it was the only Jewish feminist conference. There never was a follow-up. And it's because institutionally, the sponsor at that time, the American Jewish Congress, got a lot of PR out of it, and they were done. I know that JTS has a more honorable intention. They really want focus on this issue, so I really encourage you all to make enough of a fuss that there is a second conference on women in the rabbi. But we're invited here to talk about ourselves, our generational differences, our personal experiences, our, pardon the expression, Jewish journey. So I'm going to start by telling you very quickly what a lot of you know who have read, and I don't think ever go in and meet, but my novel, Three Daughters, because I just couldn't get all this out of my system in nonfiction. I really had to do it in fiction. As Grace Paley told me, don't write me what you know, write to find out what you don't know about what you know. And there was a lot I didn't know about my own upbringing, made no sense to me. I was very Jewishly educated. My father was a lawyer, but he also was a Talmud scholar. He also was a Baal Korech. He knew, really, he was comfortable davening, cantillation, and no vowels, and he was a bar mitzvah teacher when he was in high school, and he was grounded. And I was raised, quote, like a boy, because my father had no sons. So from the age of three, I was sent to Hebrew school. I went to Hebrew high school. I went to the Yeshiva of Central Queens for 2 years. I was among the first two girls to be bat mitzvah in conservative Judaism in 1952. You don't have to calculate, I'm 75. my rabbi, may rest in peace, a wonderful, wonderful man, but always wore a crown, which is how I see him in my mind. I cannot see this man in blue jeans. He's always in a gown and a crown. S. Gershon Levy was associated with JTS. I always knew that. And I always revered JTS because I was an absolutely loyal listener of the Eternal Life. And I knew the address, because at the end you could always send for the script of that week's Eternal Light to 38 Broadway. So I memorized it as a child, 38 Broadway, and the very first time I ever came here for an event, I felt the way my daughter did when she traveled to the scene where Downton Abbey's. So I feel deeply connected to conservative Judaism and to this institution. My journey, in very quick sort of snapshots, is that my father was very much a formal Jew. He became president of our shul. He was the county commander of Jewish war veterans. He was the head of the neighbors of Queens. He was the Macha of all Machas. Israel in my house was my sibling rival, because my parents spent all their time at, meetings of organizations during the time of the Jews, and then after the declaration of the state, helping Israel. So that's kind of father decided in my childhood. He became my tutor for my bat mitzvah. I think the only way I could keep my father at the dinner table long enough to spend a little part of the evening with him before he ran out to the men's club or the B'nai B'rith or ZOA, pardon the expression, but back then it was better. Parsha, because girls at that time got Friday night, not Saturday morning, and we only were allowed the Haftarah. Mine was Deborah, thank God. I think that was God's way, you know, she works in a mysterious way, of telling me who I was meant to pay attention to. The thing that went wrong in my childhood, quite frankly, was I lost my mother when I was 15 years old. And at that point, I was a very pious little girl. I went to shul Friday night and Saturday morning and all the holidays and all. I was deeply rooted, put it that way, in Jamaica Jewish Center in Queens. Big, big, big stuff. We had a bowling alley, which a lot of kids were envious of. But when my mother died, all of my training counted for nothing. The first night of the fiddle, when everybody gathered, my father, I could see him doing this. The room was full of Jews, but only 9 real Jews. So my father picked up the phone and called the shul and asked them to send the 10th man, because all the rest of the people in my living room were women. And I kind of grabbed him by the sleeve and I said, Dad, you can't do that, you know? I've been bat mitzvah, I've had all this education, and it's my mother. And my father said, Asur, you know it's Asur. Well, I also knew that it was Asur to drive to shul, because frankly, in 1952, it was before the tshuva that allowed conservative Jews to drive to shul. It was still forbidden. But my father drove to shul, parked 3 blocks away. My father was hopelessly addicted to cigarettes. He smoked and put out the cigarette 3 blocks away. Why couldn't I count in the minyan if he could make those exceptions? I left Judaism at 15 because if they wouldn't count me in at a time that mattered the most spiritually and emotionally, if I couldn't take advantage of the supper of my faith at the time I needed it most, I'd walk away, and I did. I left Judaism for 15 years. I did not belong. That's the word we all use when we say, where do you belong? We know what we mean. I did not belong. I was a once-a-year Jew. All of a sudden, I only went to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and I bought a ticket and sat in the overflow service in synagogues all around New York. But I practiced the home-based Judaism of my mother, because that also was an influence in my childhood. For 15 years, she gave me the tongue, the texture, the heart, the beautification of Judaism. My mother prided herself on setting a beautiful table. She made Esther out of celery and parsley and pimentos. She drew a picture of the Exodus on the dining room mirror. My mother's role in life was to make things beautiful. She was a designer for Hattie Carnegie. My mother was a superstitious Jew. I carried that into my adult life. I know that when you have something mended while you're in it, you have to chew a thread. I know that because otherwise the Ayin Hara, the evil eye, will come and the devil will think you're being sewn into your shroud and take you. I mean, that was clear. There's logic in that. You know, on your shroud is what you should be sewn into. I wasn't allowed to sleep with the moon shining in on me because the moon should only shine on your grave. I got slapped across the face when I first menstruated. How many women had that happen? The older ones. They don't do that anymore. When I asked my mother, you know, and she said something in Yiddish, and when I asked her, you know, I'd never, ever, ever been hit. What did I do? What did you just say? And she said, I just asked God that that should be the worst pain you ever know as a woman. Of course, it didn't work. All of that is to tell you that during my alienation years, 15 years, I married a Jewish man who was raised in a household where Marx and Engels were sort of Rashi. which is, you know, one reason why, no matter how radical I was as a feminist, my husband had already seen it with his mother. She was on soapboxes all over New York and New Jersey. I had three children. And I did not want my children to be inculcated into a patriarchal system that would devalue my daughters. And so I gave them no Hebrew education, no Hebrew school education. And my children, with the exception of a stellar exception here, were not bar or bat mitzvah. Abigail will tell you that she became a bat mitzvah when she was 40. She did it all on her own. I did nothing for my children except create a Jewish home. I didn't want anything to do with institutionalized Judaism, the Judaism of my father. And then I realized, when we were on Fire Island, that I had ceded Judaism to men, and that it was my religion, it was my faith, it was my tradition, and I should not have surrendered. I should not have accepted the male definition. I should not have accepted the gates were barred. That's why I said to Julie, I really object to the line in which it says, the gates open to women. The gates didn't open to women, as you heard. Women stormed the gates. Women fought for their lives. Power is never given. It must be taken. And women took it. Women did it the right way. In Judaism, women did it, in my view, the right way, by arguing their way into it, by halakhically justifying it, rather than just depending on a rights-based argument, which doesn't always happen in Judaism. But when I was on Fire Island and suddenly I overheard a bunch of men sitting on the beach and saying, wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to go back to the city for the High Holy Day service, the High Holy Days, and we could do services on some of the back deck? Well, that sounded great, and everyone was starting to figure out how they'll borrow machzorim from their synagogues and bring them out there, and they'll all, you know, pull out of a box the Cohen family bar mitzvah yarmulke and the, you know, the Schwartz family wedding yarmulke and put it all together. We have yarmulkes. We went to the store. We got them to offer free sponge cake and manischewitz wine. It's a little tiny community. It was easy to get that all set up. We set up a little beam on somebody's back. And then suddenly one of the men said, who's going to run this thing? I don't remember anything. You know, I haven't been to shul except, you know, once a year since my bar mitzvah. I don't know it. I don't know it. I don't know. And I raised my hand. This was 1970. And I said, I can do it. I'll do it. And I sat with the mazur, and I sort of chose 1 hour's worth of the greatest hits in my city. I mean, mimeographed it, because let me say, mimeographing was the state of the art at the time. And we mimeographed it, and we had maybe, you know, 35 people who had signed up, and I must say people came out of the woodwork because our community used to be a restricted community. It said it on the very schedule. So people came out of the woodwork and said, I'm Jewish, can I come? I did the service, and I felt as if I had suddenly made myself belong. I claimed belonging. Necessity was the mother of invention for this community. It would not have chosen a woman. Shortly before, but I was the only thing at hand. Come Yom Kippur, I really am suddenly getting extremely nervous. I'm a serious Jew. Do I have the right to do it? I'm really I have never heard Kol Nidrei in a woman's voice. Never. So I read about walking on the beach, and I said, well, I think it's a sign that it's okay. I happen to be a feminist and a believer, believe it or not. So suddenly, on the bay, which faces the west, there's the most dazzling sunset we've ever had there. I took it as my sign, and I chanted the Kol Nidrei. And from that time on, I was the rabbi or cantor of my synagogue. The volunteer firefighter was the rabbi. He didn't know any Hebrew, and he did the English very with stentorian tone. and that was my kind of reconnection to Judaism, to communal collective Judaism. And I've been working my way back since 1970, but I couldn't have done without feminism. So I left Judaism for a feminist reason, exclusion, and I came back for a feminist reason, being allowed to be who I was as a Jew and to express it. Jewish feminism was happening then, I didn't know it. I actually learned about it when I was one of the founders of Ms. and Paula Hyman had written a piece that I assigned to her because I had heard about Ezra Nashim and scholarship and, you know, Talmud scholars and all kinds of ferment, and I said, you know, I need to tune into this. And so I became Paula Hyman's editor, and that awakened me to what was happening in Jewish life without me. And I thought, you know, how can this be? I have to plug in. Which is how I got involved in enough of feminist ritual to feel now that I need it. I'm addicted to it. It's my fix. I was one of the founders of the feminist seder that Esther Bonner presided over for many years. It's a very precious part of my life. And this year, thank God, with Abigail present, we had our 40th feminist seder. We don't substitute, we add. Feminists don't substitute, we add. So we have our two usual sayers and we have our third sayer. People are always saying, what do you mean you want to do? You want to sweep away tradition? No, we want to add to tradition. We want to enrich, we want to embellish, we want to elaborate. We want to make it more, to make it blossom. I didn't tell you two things that matter to me. The first time when I said I came back to Judaism, the first time I came back to organized Judaism rather than Fire Island Judaism, was when I went around the corner from where I lived and joined Stephen Wise, Three Synagogue, because Sally Crosshead was there. And when I came into the synagogue and on Shabbat, and I saw Sally and Ellen Mack and a woman president of the shul, I started to cry. I couldn't believe I had lived to see this. It was so viscerally powerful for me. It was cognitive dissonance at first, and then it was ecstasy. And the next time I had that experience was the first time I was given an aliyah. When I looked down at the Torah, and I saw the letters, and they danced the way the great old rabbis say they danced. They danced, and they glimmered, and they glistened, and I realized I was this close to an object that was so distant always, where it was the Zota. That was how I saw it, up like this, far away. And now I was looking at it, and the tears flowed. That emotion is really getting to me a little, so I'm going to move on to the few messages I'd like to leave with you, other than the personal. How pluralist are we in conservative Judaism? Someone raised this morning the issue of the non-egalitarian dominion, and I think it is time to make a declaration of who we are. Stand for something. Conservative Judaism is about change, about adaptation, about recognition that we are embedded in community and we have a reality as Jews, and we attempt to respond to reality within the context of Halakha. And the argument has been made, the decision has been made, why is there this little addendum? It leads itself to the Hobby Lobby mindset. Suddenly we have to tolerate the people who would deny us our role. We have to tolerate, as Rabbi Hannah Thompson wrote in Lilith in 2013, I have conservative colleagues who won't call me for an aliyah because I'm a woman, an affront to my honor and dignity. But if I say this, I risk being accused of intolerance of those who won't recognize me. She writes, one cannot permit that which one has no authority to deny. Equality must be recognized, not granted. The revolutionary premise behind the covenant and all its laws is that all human beings belong equally to God. The issue is not tolerance of those who believe differently, but that we have not taken a stand as to what conservative Judaism holds as a fundamental principle. I agree with that. A couple of words about Jewish feminism, and then I'm going to turn it over to Abby. Jewish feminism arose out of the conservative movement, basically, because it arose in the minds and hearts of educated Jewish women. These weren't women who said, you know, I want to be able to eat a cheeseburger and be recognized as a Jew. They were not those kinds of women. They were women who said, you know, let's grapple with this. This is unjust. This is not right. They did not want to tear down. They wanted simply to use the tools of Judaism to open the doors. Women are still suffering, women in the rabbinate are still suffering what we call, might call the optics problem. And I think we need to recognize it and name it. Our voices. I sound like Baby Snooks, for those of you who remember Baby Snooks. Or many of us. I don't have that stentorian voice that the firefighter rabbi had. I'm 5'4". When I stand next to my rabbi, Marcelo Bronstein, I have to, you know, he's like 6'2". I'm not going to ever look at our rabbi as authoritative as he is in that wonderful long tallit that they keep throwing over their shoulders. That's mesmerizing, by the way. How many times during the service they go in. I watch men age into their dignity in the pulpit. Women just age. I know people out in the congregation think in terms of still of hierarchy. You know, God over man over woman over child, all of us over animals, that sort of thinking. We don't always look the part. And some women rabbis wear crocheted yarmulkes and pink tummy coats, and to me, that's not Judaism, but I'm not of this generation. I can't even wear a tallit comfortably because it's my father. I would feel like a male impersonator. But that's my generation. That's not my granddaughter, Molly's. For her, a tallit, a woman rabbi, what else is new? And finally, the issue of women and pregnancy. As I travel around talking about any Jewish issue at all, I talk to women rabbis. We talk about the pregnant rabbi as, you know, an issue. At the cemetery, people say, are you sure you want your baby exposed to death at this point? You know, the pregnant woman somehow or other at the graveside seems inappropriate. When a woman is counseling an infertile couple, here she is pregnant. A man doesn't have that issue. Sometimes it's unseemly. I know when I was pregnant with my twins, a lot of people made their children look the other way. It was too huge to explain. And the hormonal impact that sometimes makes a woman rabbi who's pregnant cry. Because the hormones are fierce and bubbling, and we get moved, and sometimes it's not something that one can control. I get tired of being a supplicant as a feminist, but that tends to be our role. I don't want to have to ask and beg and negotiate with men for simple dignity. I certainly think being pregnant and reproducing Jews is something that should be heralded and applauded and not made complicated. Okay, finally, here's one great thing, not a fetch, but a fell, a big fell. In secular feminism, we're dealing with backlash and backsliding every single day. We have to hang on to everything we want. I only think in terms of reproductive rights, and you know what I mean, because it's being that is a constitutional right that's being eroded day by day by day. In Judaism, what's won has stayed won. Celebrate that. In Judaism, yes. In Judaism, they don't suddenly say, "Okay, we're going to unroll that, ordination of yours. It no longer counts." So celebrate that. And I'm leaving you with a wonderful joke that I just found today when I Googled funny rabbi. I have clearly for the occasion changed the gender. The results of a computerized survey indicate that the perfect rabbi preaches exactly 15 minutes. She is 28 years old and has 30 years experience. She condemns sin but never upsets anyone. She is attractive to men but not threatening to women. She makes $100 a week, wears beautiful clothes, reads good books, writes great sermons, drives a good car, and gives generously to the poor. The perfect rabbi loves working with teenagers and spends all her time with seniors. She makes 15 calls a day to congregation families, visits shut-ins and the hospitalized, and is always in her office when needed. If your rabbi does not measure up, simply send this letter to 6 other synagogues that are tired of their rabbis. Then bundle up your rabbi and send her to the synagogue on the top of the list. In 1 week, you will receive 1,642 rabbis. And one of them will be perfect. Thank you.
My whole life. Welcome to Jewish Family Therapy. Through a feminist lens. A few years ago, when I was writing a cover story for New York Magazine on the 40th anniversary of Ms. Magazine, my research shocked me. I thought I knew the history. I thought, having grown up at the knee of a fairly active, unshy, pioneer mommy, that I fully understood how bad it once was for women. How much was broken and unjust before the feminist movement of the 60s and 70s came along. As a daughter, I thought I knew the story. But as a reporter, I discovered I didn't know it at all. I'd never grasped the way in which women had been publicly and easily dismissed, attacked, pigeonholed, stymied, and sidelined until I went to the Smith College Library Archive, which holds both my mom's papers and Gloria Steinem's. until I spent hours reading yellowed newspaper articles that unapologetically denigrated women in ways that are truly unimaginable today. Why was this news to me? Because I haven't lived through it. On the contrary, my mother's generation of feminists had normalized equality, and I was its beneficiary. So similarly, when it comes to where Jewish women used to be, in the rabbinate, the cantorate, on Jewish boards and foundations, I have the same lack of personal experience. I don't remember things being bad, exclusively male. I don't remember a time without a feminist seder or an orange on the seder plate, or a woman in the pulpit, or as head of the AJWS, or the JCC, or editor of the Forward. So that's progress. And everyone in this room is clearly living proof that we're not where we were. But I realize, believe me, that the work is incomplete. You in this room, more than I, can catalog the imbalances and enumerate the unfinished agenda. But the fact that I, in my travels in the Jewish world, have never experienced latent discrimination is at least some indication of Jewish feminism's success. Maybe this accounts for why, in the last few years, my Jewish writing has focused more on Judaism and Jewish engagement, or lack of it, than on gender inequality in Jewish leadership or Jewish power. I've been on what you might call a path to self-education, to make up for lost time, seeking guides like many of you to help me connect to the tradition to today, feeling progressively convinced that disaffected Jews can still be wowed by our texts and our teachings and not become another pew statistic of how Jews don't find their identity in Judaism. Judging by the women rabbis in this room and so many others outside it, I can't help thinking to myself, what is the Jewish establishment worried about? What is broken? Look at the excellence and commitment here. We are not in dire straits. All the national hand-wringing I hear at every Jewish conference I go to about the Jewish future being in peril just can't be true. As I move through the Jewish calendar this year, especially, reporting every single Jewish holiday with a seeker's hunger and obsessive commitment, I have felt more hopeful than I felt in a very long time. But I can't help wondering why this energy is not being replicated and multiplied exponentially in every shul, every JCC, every federation event, every foundation startup, every nonprofit, and every Jewish home. Because the reality is that for many Jews, what Judaism offers is still missing the mark, still failing to invigorate or inspire on the level that lasts. We all know it, though we can't always put our finger on why. There is some disconnect between what you all know Judaism can be and what the vast majority of American Jews feel or assume Jewish life or Judaism is. I was one of those people who didn't get it until I did. And Mom has taken me through my, neglected Jewish childhood. But just to sort of tell you what happened, and I'm sure you've seen it many times, you know, something kicked in for me as I grew older. I began to be bothered by the gaps in my knowledge and mastery. And as you know also so well, you can't really make up for it that well very late. It's not in your synapses. It's not in your DNA. But I sort of began sort of flailingly to do that. When I was at Yale, I took a class in Hebrew with Miri Kavovi, who was wonderful and taught us vocabulary by recording the top 40, the Israeli top 40 on the shortwave radio. So I was very cool when I brought me to Israel. I knew the top 40, but today, about 30 years old. When I graduated, Mom and Dad sent my twin sister and I to Israel. The American Jewish Congress had a tour. She thought it was going to be perfect for our, for, you know, being an undergraduate. And we got to JFK, and it turned out that she had selected the wrong tour, and everyone was over 75. I will tell you, as you can imagine, it was still the most meaningful possible first introduction to our homeland. I classmate did the naming. It was something, the bris, it was something about watching Ben come out with this oversized keep on his tiny head that made me actually panic. Because I realized I could never really explain to him what this meant or what line he was joining. And I began to feel that anxiety of ignorance as I started my book, Stars with David, which was probably my backdoor way of coming at this issue, but through celebrities. So I interviewed 62 fairly recognizable American Jews who have achieved a great deal. So that was the common denominator was just that they were Jewish and they were famous. I didn't care, I wanted them to feel safe enough to tell me the truth about what this heritage meant to them, if anything. So I sat down with Steven Spielberg and Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Larry King and Natalie Portman and all of those folks. But the person who really made the difference was probably the least famous, at least in my publisher, was Leon Musatier, who I know everyone in this room knows, until recently the literary editor of the New Republic. He was very tough on me in the interview. And when I told him that many of the people I talked to kept repeating the same thing, this doesn't do it for me. Judaism actually just, you know, it doesn't actually give me very much. And so they didn't prioritize it the way they prioritized their spinning class. Maybe people didn't spin then. I wrote the book in 2005. But he said to me, very simply, when I asked him what he would say to Jews who are struggling with their Jewish identity, he said, when Jews come to me with perplexities about the meaning of Jewishness, I say to them, Judaism. Just go to it. Check it out. Study this. Study this. Study that. Try this. Try that. Humble yourself for a while before it. Develop reasons for what you like and what you don't like. But get into the fight. Get into the fight. For some reason, that was my light bulb or my sea change. I wanted to get into the fight. Which is why I started studying Torah in intensive sessions with Rabbi Jennifer Krauss, some of you may know her. That's why I started auditing Bert Sosky's classes here at JTS. And why, 8 years ago, I started hosting a Genesis study group in my home, which morphed into an Exodus study group. First led by Bert, then by teachers from the Chon Hadar. It's why I became a Bar Mitzvah 10 years ago at age 40, and why I ultimately stumbled on Central Synagogue and became very involved. It's also why I undertook the holiday expedition for the Forward this year. I don't deserve a medal for any of that, but I do think it's proof that it's never too late to get in the game late. It's pretty obvious what happened to me. I got hooked. But here's what I think is a little less obvious. I believe every Jew can have the same experience. But it's not necessarily going to happen with the old models, which is where all of you come in and give me great optimism. We need new, recharged communicators. The most indelible moments of my reporting this year have been a conversations with rabbis and teachers like Sharon Brous, Naomi Levy, Michal Springer, Joy Levitt, Judith Sholowitz, Blue Greenberg, Yaffa Epstein, Sarah Hurwitz, Rachel Ayn, Lauren Merkin, Angela Buchdahl, Jackie Ellenson, I could go on. And with 4 holidays left, I'm hoping some of you I can still call upon. I know Ayala Cohen has been helping with Shavuot. These have been, honestly, the gift of this reporting experience, are these conversations, which actually is unfair that other people don't get to have. Being able to actually call almost any rabbi I want. Thank goodness, thanks God. No rabbi has turned me down yet. And just ask them. Tell me why I should care about Shemini Atzeret in 2014. Tell me why I should fast 6 times instead of 1. These have been amazing answers. Ed Feinstein is here. Yes, he's a man. But he's a man. Tradition to me a sense of urgency, a specificity rooted in real life, an originality, a rigor, a freshness, and frankness. Their sermons and their speeches and their perspectives pushed me to think more pointedly about my choices, my priorities, my parenting, my activism, or laziness in repairing the world. They don't say the obvious thing. They don't fall back on cliches. They don't make introspection easy. But they make liturgy, history, and ritual more integral to our lives and invigoratingly complicated. Comfort and counsel are essential parts of a rabbi's portfolio, but so is making us think. If people are not intellectually and spiritually challenged, I don't believe that they will stay connected. The gifts of transmission are not, to my mind, as widespread as they should be or could be. Not among men, yes, for its own reasons, but not also enough among women. And that's both a frustration and, I think, an opportunity. There often seems to be a gap between the strength with which women leaders feel an idea and the strength with which they communicate it. I think we need to be honest about that gap and work to close it. My mother reminds me again and again how women have been socialized to play down their power, to apologize for a point before they make it, to preface an opinion before they offer it, to lean on emotional language or vocal tone. Women were, for years, taught to adjust their delivery so they wouldn't seem strident, to dance around an argument so it wouldn't seem too commanding or prescriptive. I hope we can now stop dancing and just talk, straight and strong. I think we need to cultivate great storytellers, rousers, preachers, and poets, speakers who spend a lot of time choosing their words and sharpening their message so that it's fresh and penetrating and gets delivered in a way that kicks us in the kishes. In my experience, the times that our heritage has been brought alive is with bright, tight oratory. That's when I see Jews opt for Judaism. It's what happened to me, thanks in large part to many of you. And I do believe that if this outlier can come in late, more outliers can come in sooner. I will end with this. When people ask me and my mother how Jewish identity got passed on between us, we have to admit that it didn't. Lador Vador was not a given, and it won't be for my teenage daughter either. It needs to be ignited and earned in every generation. But with all of you at the tiller and the work of our foremothers lighting the way, the future looks extremely bright to me. Thank you.
So, when are you going to forgive me? Okay, should we have
questions?
We'll go right to questions. And we'll interact. We'll interact whenever it's appropriate.
Or do we have cards or do we let people speak?
Oh, okay. Okay. Are there
any hurt you, I think we can also win.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so there's no filtering of this. How can we inspire and challenge people who won't walk in the door or listen to us? You self-selected to challenge yourself, to learn, to research, experiment with Judaism. What about those who don't self-select, like those in my small town who won't walk into my synagogue, or those on the board who won't tolerate innovation? That's a good question. You want to start with
me? No, it's your question.
I think it's a great question, and you know, you can kind of hear that I'm sort of evangelical on this, because once you've seen it, you could sort of think it's possible to be good everywhere, and I realize the hurdles. you know, Central Synagogue is an anomaly, and it's not because I'm there that there's a waiting list. It's really very, every place else I go is obviously having the same struggles to get people in the door and make them stay.
Not the rejection.
Okay. Let's just have a synagogue off. So I would say, you know, these are longer conversations, but I think that part of the beginning is to recognize boredom. I think people actually don't say the word. And even though everyone in this room thinks that's absurd because it's obviously what you live and you're charged by this daily, I think that congregants, first of all, have that anxiety of ignorance, and that's a big barrier. They feel like, oh my God, hey, there's just so much I don't know. How could I possibly begin? To confront the barriers, honestly, I think doesn't happen very often. And frankly, to confront the boredom. I wrote a piece that actually did that go pretty viral in Catholic about the high holidays. I was just begging for some explanation. I don't need teaching, I don't need dumbing it down, but little drops, select drops of why we are where we are, and what just questions or moments that in some way, for those of us who don't understand why things are coming when they're coming exactly, or frankly, or just getting a little numb by the 10th hour. You know, let's just recognize that that happens. It doesn't mean that people shouldn't come to synagogue all day long. But sometimes there just isn't an honesty, I think, about where people really are. And to me, that is not bells and whistles. I am not saying that people should suddenly have TV screens and, you know, huge marching bands at all. I think, for me, it's in the tradition. It's just figuring out how to sort of translate that for the person who is probably like me, sort of a little bit either on the cusp or is really a beginner. I don't know if that helps at all.
I just will add a little anecdote, which is recently cousin or nephew or whatever relationship. We went to in New Jersey or Pennsylvania.
Yes.
I have that view like the New Yorker cover of everything. We were there and we looked at each other. We could not believe how boring these services were because I'm in Bnei Jeshurun and she's at Central Synagogue. We're never bored. And, you know, what was going on in that moment was a shanda. There was a performing seal of a rabbi.
I'm sorry.
Okay. All right. I shouldn't have said that. A shanda rabbi. Sorry. But there was a rabbi who simply was being a performer, put it that way. And the cantor was singing because he had a nice voice, and the congregation was not with them at all. Many people weren't even turning the pages of the siddur. And they didn't sing with them, and they didn't follow the Hebrew, and clearly no one had been invited to like an introductory prayer book Hebrew course or anything. So it was like, no wonder. The only people in that shul were the people who were the relatives of the bar mitzvah boy. Maybe there were 9 other people in that show, and you can see why. So I just support exactly what she said.
This is for you.
For Letty, how do you keep the energy up to keep fighting? It's tiring to keep being the first to do something or the first to innovate for people who don't seem to want you. What is the Talmudic thing about you're not required to finish the job? Okay, I don't have to say it because you all know it. I'm not going to say it. I'll just be like Job 63. So, but that's basically how I feel about it. I am not permitted to desist. I'm just not. I can't move through the world and see an injustice and see something that's not working and see something that hurts people. When I can do something about it, I can reach out, I can make network people, I can put, you know, give somebody something to read that will make them want to do A, B, and C, pull together a group, because clearly, you know, 8 of us are complaining, so that's a group. It's not in my constitution to just sit at the breakfast table and, you know, complain about hobby. I have to get involved. And I have to get involved in Jewish terms the same way. And they're not going to be rewards. I remember in 1976, I said to myself, you know, by 1979, we're going to get equality because we were getting so many bills passed and
we were marching and we were changing corporate life and we were changing the packaging on toys and everything was getting more non-sexist and we had teachers who were, you know, suddenly responsive to the bias in the classroom. I thought by 1979, we're going to get this thing solved. And then we had Reagan. So we never committed up.
My answer to that question is that energy has never been my mom's problem.
That's for me. Given your commitment to pregnant rabbis, shouldn't JTS offer paid leave? Shouldn't synagogues? Oh my, thank you for whatever put there. Politically speaking, there's a lot that we can do as institutions to lead the way. And if we can't afford to, you know, change the way things are done that impact not just women but whole families, then how dare we view ourselves as a light unto the world? We know better. So there are paradigms. There is, thank God for Schiffer, who if she gets mentioned one more time, she's going to have to go up on the wall. I won't mention you, but
change your policies,
and everybody should. Has reified a policy, and she had 100, her target was to get 100 Jewish organizations, synagogues, institutions to sign on to a policy about paid parental leave, and she's got 95. So I hope that JTS is not one of them.
What are your hopes for your children and grandchildren Jewishly?
Well, you do the children, and I'll do the grandchildren.
My hope for my children, I have a son and a daughter. My son's 18, and my daughter's almost 16. Is just that they are, I mean, I will use the word jazz by Judaism. I'm sure that's an awful slogan in this room, because it's very reductive. But it's actually true. Like, I want this to be something that they choose, because it is as enticing and challenging and then ultimately important as anything in their lives. But I don't actually think it can be forced upon them. And we're talking as if everything was smooth. I mean, I'm very close to my mother, but when she came back to Judaism, there was so much guilt and so much sort of agonizing about what we now didn't know because she didn't give it to us. When she still had it all, you know, my mom's still on her plane, her return was pretty full-throated. And she had it to return to because she just had it. And so it was hard to sit at the, you know, Rosh Hashanah Eve dinner table and just feel the kind of constant disappointment with how much we didn't know. And that's a danger. I just think, I understand it. If it was her own, you know, playing out her own decisions with us. But I think that that's why sometimes people say it skips a generation, because so many kids I know just feel their parents' sort of wishes and expectations, and it's not, obviously, I ultimately chose it for myself. My siblings did not. They're in different places. But I just think it's important to be aware of sort of like, what is the fine family dynamic of expectation and guilt, and what is actually making this thing something that is sort of twinkling in their lives that they actually wouldn't want to live without. So that's my hope.
I hate when I say this, but it explains it. It explains my emotional baggage, and that is that my children were the casualties of my rebellion. They were, and it's a regret I will live with for the rest of my life. But I can't do anything about it, and you know, I blame patriarchy. I don't blame you. Very hard to forgive myself. Very hard, because it could have been another way entirely. It could have been, and we would have a different picture. But in any case, I need to do a commercial here for my daughter. I really don't want to embarrass her, but she is the most creative innovator. judaically that I've ever seen in my life. And I really, I've been to synagogues all over the country and the world. And I've never seen anybody who makes Judaism come to life for children the way she does. And our Seder is a place you would all be paid to come to because kids can't wait to come. When is the Seder? What's our part? She involves them. She gives them challenges. She hides things under the plate that people have to do. She has them enact things. She gives them quizzes. We do Speed McGee. The stuff that goes on at our table is more fun, more alive, more vibrant. My Seder is in my life. My grandfather at the head of the table and his kittle. Really, the whole Haggadah was in his chest. The women stood beside the men. Each family, each couple did a kiddush. And the women stood there and looked up at the men and said a kiddush. The women did nothing but run in and out to the kitchen and carry the food and take out the food and prepare the food, and they captured the house. And they were like invisible except for their labors. Our Seder is nothing like that. So I know it's possible, and I wish that I had had the epiphanic moment that I've had since and could have relived my children's travels. Unable to do that, all I can say is I am so grateful that she's in charge of holidays in our family.
Thank you. Okay, this is to me. Thousands of people have come along with you on your journey. What has been the reaction of friends who have not accompanied you, and what can you do to engage them? Well, it took every one of us personally and rejection. Tell you how that feels. You know, I mean, honestly, one of my good friends is here, who meets everyone, and I am very aware of which of my friends, close friends, respond. And this is what I really feel. It's more than Harry and Sally thing, but I want what she's having. I do, and this is, I'm not playing the violins about the work I do, but I want it, especially for your crowd, to have a discipline and a rigor of research for the series. I wanted to approach it so that it would be not unimpeachable, because what in Judaism is ever unimpeachable, but for people to not be able to say they're not doing their homework. I do my homework, and believe me, all of you have written so many reams of things, and there are so many videos, and there's so many sermons online, and there's so many books, and I'm, you know, that started way back, you know, when I conceived the series in May. I spent the summer, you know, it was the best possible kind of reading project. And that's a way of saying I wanted my friends to be turned on to do some of that in their own lives. Not because they're going to write a series, because it is time consuming, I don't want to tell you that. But to have a taste of just how much is out there that is interesting. And so that's, I would say, a disappointment. But what is incredibly gratifying is that there I am in a world of Jews that don't know what you all know and are coming to me and saying that makes me feel very differently about that. I might actually dance with you next year on Simchat Torah if you do that again. I will drink with you. I didn't know Jews drank this much. So a lot of holidays where there's a lot of scotch and sticks. So that's been the joy of it, is that some of us lesser area Jews are, I think, a little richer, hopefully, for the series. I should do the next question.
Okay, I also have one here.
Okay. What is that?
Abby Emblin. I'm so touched by your presentation as a mother and daughter. Given how gender issues and discrimination obviously continue, and based on your experience, how do you recommend that mothers and daughters, as well as women rabbis and their students and congregants, engage around areas of gender struggle? Excellent question. I love having a smarter audience. What a pleasure. By just going at it head on, I mean the way I think we do in our lives in general. I mean, we do it on the phone. It feels like every day, maybe it's every other day. I mean, we engage all the issues in our lives in that very honest and direct way. And without fear of being stupid, you know, because there are going to be moments when mother or daughter, depending on who is the more Jewishly grounded, might feel stupid. And we have to be able to make a safe space
We have to be able to say there are lots of gradations along the spectrum. What speaks to you? What's emotionally authentic for you? I agree with Abigail that without that emotional hook, Judaism is rote. I mean, really, it's a lot. The Judaism I grew up with, where he would sign it to somebody and they just read it. Just simply read it. You could see there was no transformational kind of experiential thing going on at all. They were there to show up, mostly men. They were there to show up, to be seen showing up, to be seen dominating, you know, more than anybody, rocking more than anybody, you know, following along, pointing at the page to the newcomer, very proud of that, people walking up and down the aisle, making sure everyone's on the right page. There was a lot of that. And not very much what I saw of inspirational. So between mothers and daughters, and women rabbis and their students, there should be an unashamed appeal to where's the hook? Where will you feel most authentically, deeply, heartfelt Judaism? And then you get in, and as Abigail said, and we all know, the study of it is so there's such a method in that. Once you know, and once you know how to peel things back, and once you engage the text, I mean, this shouldn't be a secret that rabbis keep. You know, it has to be shared, and it should be taught, and it should be given to people right away, and not wait until you know exactly what the difference is between the Jerusalem and the Babylonian Talmud. It should be given to people this right to engage the text and peel that onion together.
I only really have 2 minutes, so what I just want to add, because I do think we should disagree a little. I agree with what she said, but I'm wary of words like emotional hook, even though I'm talking about finding meaning. For me, and I know I've been told this, for many people, they don't start with the intellectual and then feel. But that, for me, is one recipe I don't think people try enough. Which is, I think what Jews understand, they begin to feel all of it. You feel the power of the history, you feel the power of the chain. The Torah in front of you is overwhelming. But I think sometimes, we have to admit, people associate a female brand of Judaism with a crunchier, softer, less rigorous brand of Judaism. I know that's not the case, but I do see that there's some care that has to be taken about female stereotypes around softening things and making them kind of less authentic. I think Judaism absolutely can be authentic and play to the strength that actually we have to completely celebrate come from women, but not necessarily because they are female, if that makes sense. And I just worry a little bit about the language of emotion.
We have talked at length between ourselves about Naseh v'Nishma, what that exactly means in terms of, you know, should people do first and listen or figure things out later. You know, different people have different pathways. So maybe we should leave it at that as a statement of yours.
My great life passions, Judaism and feminism. I actually remembered when you were speaking that my first magazine subscription that I ever bought for myself when I was in high school was Ms. Magazine. So thank you so much. I'd like to thank members of the general public who joined us for these open sessions and to wish you farewell. And for those of us that are registered for the rest of the program and for dinner, we're going to be in the dining hall.